Hi, it's Patrick here, learning those languages, and occasionally, no, often, making grave errors. It's okay, of course, to mangle a foreign language in the sanctity of a classroom, but the stakes are higher just about everywhere else. Today, we'll be hearing a couple of high-end linguistic mistakes. Also, we'll be checking in on a school where bilingual education is banned, but a form of it nonetheless takes place, much to the relief of some of the teachers. Also, Pakistani kids start learning Chinese, their fourth language for many of them, and a Chinese classical musician on the links between language and music. Oh, I just have to play one of those linguistic no-nos. This from a former British ambassador to Israel.
The Hebrew for breast was shad, and the Hebrew for chicken was off. And I remember once going to a restaurant and ordering chicken breast, and what I'd actually ordered was the breast of a woman on a chicken.
As a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
I'm here with Patrick, and it's time to talk words.
Rah. New words, old words, censoring everything.
The World in Words podcast and the World Radio program, The Big Show, are both co-productions of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH radio station here in Boston. Online, The Big Show is at theworld.org. The podcast is at theworld.org/language. My blog posts that accompany each podcast edition are at patrickcox.wordpress.com, also at theworld.org/language. I'm on Twitter at Patrick Cox, PatriCox, and there is a Facebook page called The World in Words. On today's pod, the value and pitfalls of language learning for roving diplomats. Also, a bold move in Pakistan to have kids learn Chinese. And then how music echoes the human voice in all its diversity, as envisioned by a US-based Chinese musician. Before all of that, the second part of our series on bilingual education, or rather, the lack of it. If you heard last week's pod, you'll recall that several states have banned bilingual education, the fear being that kids aren't learning enough English. The series that we're running last week, this week, and next week, all of these pieces, they look at the consequences of such a ban. In this case, nearly a decade later, the state in question is Massachusetts, where voters approved a ban on bilingual education in 2002. That vote was known as Question 2. So in a city such as Boston, that has thousands of Spanish-speaking kids as their home language in public schools, let alone all the other native languages, what to do? Well, there are options. Reporter Andrea Smarden of WGBH visited a Boston elementary school where teachers are bringing Spanish back into the classroom.
It was 2003, and voters had just approved a state ballot measure requiring students to learn in English. Second-grade teacher Christine Cronin was starting her new job at Dever Elementary School when she realized she had a major problem. Half of her students did not speak English, yet she was responsible for teaching them to read in a language they didn't know.
I can teach you that the name of this letter is N, and the sound that it makes is N. But then, you know, as I go on from other instruction, I'm thinking about the pictures that I'm asking them to associate with this letter N. They don't know what these things are called. They don't know what a net is in English. They're not calling it a net. And I remember thinking at that moment, do I just give them a Spanish word that you'd hear the N sound in?
In the past, Cronin spoke Spanish and English to her students. But after Question 2 passed, teachers all over Massachusetts had to put away their bilingual materials.
What I really just wanted to do was pull out my things from when I taught in Spanish and say, okay, here we go. This is N. It says N, just like I said before. And here's the words it sounds like, you know, and pulling pictures that made sense in Spanish because they started with that sound. And like really teaching them how to read, because I knew that if they learned that, then they would get the English reading, you know, pretty quickly.
Cronin felt that she was handicapping her students by not using their native language. She says she still harbors guilt about the students who couldn't read when they left her class.
I have one student in mind who would be probably seventh grader right now. He never became a good reader. In second grade, I had the opportunity to teach him to make meaning out of reading, and I felt like I couldn't, and I feel like I failed him.
After struggling with this approach for a few years, Cronin and other teachers decided to try another model, a dual language program.
Mama. El perrito, Fifi, Fifi con mayúscula.
Oh my God.
Yes, that's Spanish you're hearing in this second grade classroom, but in this case, it is allowed. The law mostly eliminated bilingual programs, but there is an exception. Schools can use a dual language approach, immersing students in two languages alternately, as long as one of them is English. So this week at Dever, these second graders are learning exclusively in Spanish. Next week, they will be taught only in English. The students are working on their writing skills in small groups. At one table, a native Spanish speaker is helping a student whose first language is English. She helps him spell the Spanish word for sports.
D.
Cronin says this approach allows students to learn not only from their teacher, but from each other.
In the dual language model, the children sitting next to them are a mixed group of English speakers, Spanish speakers, and so they're being pushed during their English time to use the English skills that they're developing. And then they also get the opposite time where they're the language models and they are teaching their peers how to speak good Spanish.
According to Cronin, the school is already seeing promising gains with the dual language approach. She says far fewer students are struggling to read. And she says the program allows students to use the skills they already have in their native language.
One of the things that was most attractive to us was the idea that it's an additive model. So it's the idea that being bilingual is a good thing, as opposed to it's a problem that needs to get fixed, which is kind of the attitude that was behind the referendum question.
Cronin doesn't believe that the English-only law is the best approach, but she does agree with the idea that students need to learn English.
In our country, English is the language of academics. It's the language of power. It's the language of achievement. We need kids to be able to listen, speak, read, and write at a high level in English. And I think that's why question two got a foothold, is that there were programs that were not working effectively to get to that ultimate goal of kids being able to be successful here. So I think that's always has to be a number one goal. It's the ways in which you get there that differ.
The State Department of Education was not able to say how many dual language programs there are, but a recent UMass study shows 2% of English language learners are in dual language programs. All other public schools are required to teach students in English, unless parents sign a waiver requesting bilingual assistance for their child. For 89.7 WGBH, I'm Andrea Smartin.
Okay, part three next week with another approach and another language. And now to a favorite theme of the pod, and that is the lack of foreign language speakers in government. I think we've looked at this from all kinds of perspectives, or at least with all kinds of government agencies, the CIA, the Pentagon. We've done a bunch of stuff on the State Department. And all of these places, it's a constant struggle to recruit enough speakers of foreign languages, when clearly with these particular agencies, it's critical. There are many recruitment and training programs out there, but their effect has been limited. Well, not surprisingly, other English-speaking nations have similar struggles. In Britain, the equivalent of the Secretary of State, that is, Foreign Minister, his name is William Hague, he has just launched a sharp attack on the culture of the Foreign Office, the department he runs, the equivalent of the State Department. He said previous governments had allowed language learning among diplomats at the Foreign Office to wither on the vine. So he's promised to devote more resources to language training, which they probably all heard before. But it is quite remarkable because this is a time when the overall budget of the British government, but also of the Foreign Office, is shrinking. British diplomats, he says, need to be under the skin of the locals in the countries where they're posted. And in his view, that means understanding the local language. Now, this all sounds very serious, and the discussion that follows certainly has a lot of serious moments in it, but it's also, well, you'll hear, it's funny. We're going to hear from veteran diplomat Sherrod Cooper-Coles. He's a former British ambassador to Israel, to Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. He wrote a memoir of his time in Afghanistan called Cable from Kabul. We're also going to hear from David Bellis, who's director of the Program in Translation and Intercultural Communication at Princeton University. His new book, which I can't wait to read, I've read snippets of it, is called Is That a Fish in Your Ear? It's a History of Translation. Asking the questions is the BBC's James Naughtie.
Professor Bellos, do you think that the business of learning language to understand a culture, despite globalization and the internet, is still as important as it ever was?
Yes, I do. I think the experience of learning a language is an integral part of a real education, not just because it enables you to get more of a fix on a foreign culture, but because at bottom it helps you a great deal to understand your own language and culture. Mm. Diplomacy is a bit special, but I would first like to make a plea that, you know, languages are best learnt when you are young. The brain is just
is
so much more
news,
able.
I know, yeah.
And it really is sad that in this country, and in many English-speaking countries, I mean, there are other countries too that are not particularly brilliant at this anymore, are really letting down our youngsters, our future leaders, by the contraction in language teaching at
a
teenage
comment
level.
About, you know, the numbers learning French, German at A level, for example, particularly German, I think it's going down rather dramatically, which people talk about. Sherrod Cooper-Coles, let me ask you, first of all, do you think language training's taken a bit of a back seat in the Foreign Office in recent years?
Well, it did for a year or two, Jim, and William Hague, whose speech I was at last week, has announced a big increase, £1 million extra a year, and most important, revival of the Diplomatic Service Language Centre, a sort of mini-university inside the Foreign Office, for learning, as David says, not just foreign languages, but about foreign cultures. I went to the British Spy School in Lebanon, the famous MICAS, the last lot to go there, but there we learnt not only Arabic, but about the Arabs and the Arab world, and also, I'm glad to say, about Israel.
Yeah, well, I think I'm right in saying you learned Hebrew when you went to Israel, but not all ambassadors to Israel do, because you can get by in English. But did you teach yourself, or did the office do it for
you? Yes, with rather mixed results.
Well, you used to go on television and talk
well,
in Hebrew,
yes,
didn't you?
Well, yes, but it's better to try and fail, I think, sometimes.
Well,
I learned,
exactly.
For example, that the Hebrew for breast was shad, and the Hebrew for chicken was off. And I remember once going to a restaurant and ordering chicken breast, and what I'd actually ordered was the breast of a woman on a chicken.
Did you get it?
I got some very surprised looks.
Yes, yeah, well, no, quite. But the business, David Bellos, I mean, you're interested in this whole question, that not just at the level of official diplomacy and government-to-government relations, but the business of understanding the comprehension of a different culture is something that's fundamental, isn't it?
Absolutely, of course. And simply knowing the grammar and vocabulary is not all there is to learning a language, but it's an essential first point. There are many levels at which you can acquire a foreign language, but even a very basic familiarity with a language of another culture gives you a step into it. It gives you a way into it. I mean, obviously, not all diplomats are going to be fluent in all the languages of the countries where they're posted.
No, they wouldn't be expected to be.
They can't possibly be. But if they have experience of learning a language to a high level, then they know how to know much better how to go about getting the elements of another one.
And and you talk, Sherrod Cooper-Coles, for example, about Arabic and about MICAS, because there are so many countries which speak versions, I mean, very different versions of Arabic. Now, if the Foreign Office doesn't have efficient training in that language, then it's going to lose out enormously in the quality of people who go there, and there's bound to.
Yes, no, you're absolutely right. But it's not just Arabic, it's also French and basic European languages. But there are dangers, Jim, in overconfidence. When I was in the embassy in Paris, Tony Blair, who'd learned his French in a bar outside Paris on his gap year, thought he could speak French, and he decided to tell the French Prime Minister in French. They'd had a rather drinky lunch in the Dun Cow pub in Sedgefield. He decided to say to the French press that he'd always been envious of Lionel Jospin and his policies and whatever position he'd taken. And he said in French, j'ai toujours envie de Lionel, même en toute position, tout le temps. I've always lusted after you, Lionel, in every position, whatever. And Jospin went bright red and said to the French press,
being a rather austere man,
being an austere Protestant, and said, Monsieur le Premier Ministre, ne voulez pas dire ça.
Well, we all remember Ted Heath speaking French. Do you remember with Je suis convaincu que, etc.? Yes.
I think learning a language, you do have to get far enough to know how much you haven't yet learned.
Well, exactly. Well, let us hope that the diplomatic service gets as far as to know what it doesn't know, thanks to William Hague's extra £1 million a year. So shout out Cooper Coles and Professor David Bellows from Princeton. Thanks very much, both of you.
Okay, so while politicians and diplomats may or may not be learning how to make faux pas in who knows how many foreign tongues, some, perhaps many more Pakistanis may one day be speaking Chinese. The Pakistani province of Sindh has raised a lot of eyebrows with a plan to make Chinese mandatory in public schools. The aim is that by 2013, all children, 10 or older, will be learning Chinese, Mandarin Chinese. We called up Harun Rashid to talk about this. He's with the BBC's Urdu section in Islamabad. We ran a very short interview with Harun on the big show. So on the pod, I'm going to let the tape roll a little bit longer. Asking the questions is the big show's Marco Werman.
Why Chinese? Why this decision?
You know, China is one of the biggest trading partners of Pakistan. And the government here has always been saying that China has been Pakistan's time-tested friend. Whenever Pakistan was in dire straits, China has helped Pakistan return to normalcy or stand on its feet. And President Zardari has made it a habit as well that every 3 months he goes to China for furthering cooperation between the two countries.
You know, fair enough, Harun, but to take, you know, probably what's going to be 5 hours a week and tell children that they've got to learn this new language, a rather complicated language. I mean, critics of the plan say it's innately political. Maybe you can tell us how.
Yeah, it is. It is, in a way, trying to show China or trying to woo China more towards Pakistan as it emerges as an international economic giant. So it is for that reason that Pakistan needs China more than maybe China needs Pakistan.
Is there a sense, too, Harun, that Pakistan has such tough relations with the U.S. and India right now that they figure they ought to cozy up with some big, important, powerful country? So how about China?
Yeah, of course, that is one of the reasons. So on political front, yes, China might support Pakistan as it has done over the years. But because Pakistan is a very small market compared to the United States or India, I think people here quite frankly know that China would always be listening to India and the United States more than Pakistan.
Is there a sense that this program could expand to the entire country? Could all 10-year-olds in Pakistan start learning Chinese?
I doubt that it can happen so quickly because the decision that has been announced would take 2 years to implement. And finding the right teachers, the right equipment, and the right infrastructure would take some time. Another problem is that by 2013, we will have new elections, so People's Party would not be in power. So it remains to be seen whether the next government that comes into power stick to this decision or would they, because political parties in Pakistan have their inclinations. Some are more pro-Saudi Arabian, some are more pro-Iranian, and some are more Chinese. So it will have to be seen whether the political party that comes to power in the next general elections in 2013, whether they stick to this decision or not.
So English is currently the language of instruction in Pakistan, right?
No, Urdu is basically, but in Sindh province, yeah, the national language here is Urdu, which is taught in all the educational institutions of Pakistan. But apart from Urdu, English is a compulsory subject and also their local Sindhi language. So students will already be learning three languages. And if Chinese is made the fourth one, it will be, some say, an extra burden on some students as well. So they are asking to make this subject not compulsory, but optional to help these students select the language that they want.
We've heard rumors that Pakistan's President Zardari's daughter is planning to study Chinese in China after graduating from college. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, President Zardari is quite a big champion of Chinese.
Does he speak it himself?
No, I don't think so. Although, as I said, he has made it his habit that every 3 months he does visit China to learn the model of development that they have implemented so that it can be imitated in Pakistan as well.
Harun Rashid, senior editor with the BBC's Urdu section in Islamabad. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Okay, we'll stay with Chinese now, but with a native Chinese speaker, a musician whose group has just played a couple of concerts at a big jazz festival in Beijing, the Nine Gates Jazz Festival. I reported this story, and, well, I hope it gives a sense of how learning a musical instrument or learning a particular musical genre is somewhat akin to learning a language, partly in how you have to inhabit a different world, but also because the words that we use and the way that we say them, that gets reflected in styles of music. And if all that's the case, you'd have to say that this musician is quite the polyglot. Enough pretentiousness, here goes. Yang Ying grew up in the 1960s and 70s during China's Cultural Revolution. It was a time when people deemed enemies of communism were forced to work as manual laborers. That happened to Yang's father. He ended up working in a coal mine. He thought his daughter might escape that fate if he taught her to play an instrument well enough that she could enter an elite music academy. And so, Yang says, she learned to play the traditional two-string ahu.
We have a very, very small and poor condition apartment, so we cannot practice at home. So every morning, 5 o'clock, my daddy will run with my brother and me to the park, and I will practice at the park.
Yang won a national competition playing this famous piece. It's called River of Tears. Her success led to a place at a music conservatory in Beijing. From there, she became a soloist with the Chinese National Song and Dance Ensemble. She performed for countless foreign dignitaries on their visits to China, including American presidents.
Like, I played for Ford, Carter, and Nixon. I remember three. I probably performed for more.
More important to Yang, though, were her tours of China, where she learned about the country's regional differences, the music, and the dialects.
The dialect is the most important thing. You go to different places, they talk about it in a different way. That really affect on the music.
But while Yang was being exposed to new sounds, she still had to perform the same old stuff.
You probably only play 2, 3, 4 repertoires for your whole life. I was often play those repertoires and I was getting tired, and I really want to do something new.
It was the late 1980s. China was opening up. Yang started going to rock concerts put on by the U.S. Embassy. Clubs were opening, bands forming. She thought, why not? She taught herself the bass guitar. She said it was like learning a new language. This is Cobra, China's first ever all-female rock band. In starting the group and performing songs like this one, Yang knew that she was breaking several taboos at once and that her ensemble colleagues, and especially her father, would disapprove.
When he heard I play rock music, he was not very happy, you know. And also people around me, dancers, musicians, they all thought I was crazy.
Yang tried to infuse some of Cobra's songs with traditional elements. That ultimately moved Yang in another direction. She emigrated to the U.S. and started studying jazz. She recognized common elements between jazz and Chinese folk music. Both rely on improvisation. And both, she says, make the instrument sound as if it's singing, like the human voice. It made sense to Yang to play the arhu with an American jazz group. And now it makes sense to bring that sound back home to China. Yang Ying hopes that she's invited to play many more times in her native land. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox. All right, that's it for this week. And for those of you wishing that I would do more Reading Sideways segments, well, please send me yours. My email address is language@pri.org, or you can tweet me or post something on Facebook. But for now, just consider this week's kind of inverted Eating Sideways, as we heard from Sherrod Cooper-Coles quoting Tony Blair.
J'ai toujours envie de Lionel, même en toute position, tout le temps. I've always lusted after you, Lara, yes. In every position.
See you on Facebook or Twitter or theworld.org. More next week.